since I was last sprawled coquettishly on the otherwear sofa, our microphone positioned so that the studio lights fall on my eager upturned face as I lean towards it to speak. Yes, it can, and is. Hello and welcome to another edition of Otherwear, where this week we'll find out why it might feel like time is speeding up, and if there's any truth to the notion that everything seems to be taking longer to do. We'll explore whether or not our bodies emit light, if meditation can make certain parts of your brain bigger, how swimming with dolphins can lift depression, as well as how arguments can slow down the healing process. We'll find out about nanotech robots that behave like DNA, and a recent discovery in the Guatemalan jungle that has been likened to the Sistine Chapel. And basically, it's the usual feast of close encounters of the multidimensional kind. And if that sounds vaguely like we might be spending a portion of our time talking about aliens, you're right, as later in the show we'll venture into the newly charted realms of exopolitics and human relations with advanced civilizations from outer space, as Otherwear crosses live to Canada and welcomes special guest and exopolitics frontman Alfred Weber to the show. Joining us will be fellow Canadian and newest member of the Otherwear team, roving reporter and all-round frontiers man Eric McIntosh. He'll be appearing regularly on the show to bring us a veritable cornucopia of stories that all fall under the banner of Otherwear. And in this first hour, I'll be introducing him to you as we chat with Eric about Indigo Kids, the new energy movement, and clean technology, amongst many other things. My name is Liz Miller, and it's my pleasure to be your host, and this week you're listening to the extended remixed version of Otherwear, coming to you for 2 whole hours. So stay tuned, and if you're feeling the pressure of the holiday season, which is upon us once again, make sure you're somewhere comfortable for the final portion of the show, where we go into an extended journey into relaxation. What is Otherwear? Otherwear is anything that activates, enhances, or evolves the inner technologies of the multidimensional human. Albert Einstein once said, "The significant problems we face cannot be solved at the same level of thinking we were at when we created them." And in August, right here on this network, Dr. Fred Bell, whose show Health, Science and Energy precedes this one each week, echoed those same thoughts when he said the way to stop terrorism is to raise consciousness. They are profound statements that cut to the essence of what BBS Radio and this show is all about, informing and hopefully inspiring you to expand your mind, your beliefs about yourself and the world we live in. So, each week at the start of the show, I'll be bringing you some of the most fascinating and enlightening news stories on the Otherwear front I can find, so that we can approach our lives more creatively and in the process awaken some more of our own inner technologies. One of those inbuilt technologies involves the ability to heal ourselves and purely through the use of quantum energy, which is what is referred to when we use the terms energetic healing or vibrational medicine. I've personally been working with an energetic healing technique for the last 12 months called the Healing Codes, and as the practitioner, whether we are working on ourselves or someone else, we visualize light being emitted from our fingers. That's then directed at certain healing centers in the brain by pointing our fingers at the specific place where we are sending the light. It doesn't involve any equipment, any medicine, or anything else for that matter, except for our hands and conscious awareness. It's similar in that way to how Reiki and other forms of hands-on healing is done. Of course, the light itself is invisible to our eyes, but more often than not, it can be felt, sometimes quite strongly, as a tingling or warm sensation, even when the practitioner's hands are not actually touching the person's body. First up, here's a fantastic news story for all the energetic healers out there, and for anybody who has been to one or is considering going to one. It's always great when science comes through with some measurable proof that there's really more going on than your imagination. A study finds that human hands emit light. Again from Discovery.com, this one from Jennifer Viegas. Human hands glow, but fingernails release the most light, according to a recent study that found all parts of the hand emit detectable levels of light. The findings support prior research that suggested most living things, including plants, release light. Since disease and illness appear to affect the strength and pattern of the glow, the discovery might lead to less invasive ways of diagnosing patients. Mitsuo Hiramatsu, a scientist at the Central Research Laboratory at Haramatsu Photonics in Japan, led the research and revealed that the hands are not the only parts of the body that shine light by releasing photons or tiny energized increments of light. Not only the hands, but also the forehead and bottoms of our feet emit photons, Hiramatsu said, and added that in terms of hands, the presence of photons means that our hands are producing light all of the time. The light is invisible to the naked eye, of course, so Hiramatsu and his team used a powerful photon counter to see it. The detector found that fingernails release 60 photons, fingers release 40, and the palms are the dimmest of all, with 20 photons measured. The findings are published in the current Journal of Photochemistry and Photobiology. Hiramatsu is not certain why fingernails light up more than the other parts of the hand, but he said it may be because of the optical window property of fingernails, meaning that the fingernail works somewhat like a prism to scatter light. To find out what might be creating the light in the first place, he and a colleague had test subjects hold plastic bottles full of hot or cold water before their hand photons were measured. The researchers also pumped nitrogen or oxygen gas into the dark box where the individuals placed their hands as they were being analysed. Warm temperatures increased the release of photons, as did the introduction of oxygen. Rubbing mineral oil over the hands also heightened light levels. Based on those results, the scientists theorize the light is a kind of chemiluminescence, a luminescence based on chemical reactions, such as those that make fireflies glow. The researchers believe that 40% of the light results from the chemical reaction that constantly occurs as our hand skin reacts with oxygen. Since mineral oil, which permeates into the skin, heightens the light, they also now think 60% of the glow may result from chemical reactions that have taken place inside the skin. Fritz Albert Popp, a leading world expert on biologically related photons at the International Institute of Biophysics in Germany, agrees with the findings and was not surprised by them. Popp says, "One may find clear correlations to the type and severity of diseases. Popp and his team believe the light from the forehead and the hands pulses out with the same basic rhythms, and that these pulses become irregular in unhealthy people. A study he conducted on musculosclerosis patient seemed to validate the theory. Both he and Hiramatsu hope future studies will reveal more about human photon emissions, which could lead to medical diagnosis applications." By the way, it was Dr. Popp's research back in 1970 that was the first to ever demonstrate that this light, or biophoton emissions, is actually coming from within our DNA. He experimented with dropping a chemical called ethidium bromide onto DNA samples and watched how it caused the DNA to unwind and release larger and larger amounts of light the more it became unwound. Cool, huh? If you'd like to find out more about Popp's work and other researchers into the quantum field, I'd highly suggest reading The Field, The Quest for the Secret Force in the Universe, a HarperCollins book by Lynn McTaggart, published in 2001. I love dolphins, and in the new year, Otherware will be proud to bring you, and to the BBS airwaves, Hawaiian-based dolphin and cetacean researcher and communicator, Joan Ocean, who you can find on the web at www.joanocean.com. And yes, that is her real name. Earlier this year, Joan inaugurated the very first Dolphin and ET Civilizations Conference in Hawaii, bringing together some of the world's greatest minds in the field of dolphin research, human-cetacean communication, and ET contact. Now, Discovery.com brings us a story about how taking a dip with dolphins can be a tremendous therapy for people with depression, according to a study to be published in the weekly British Medical Journal. Nature lovers, or biophiles, to give them their scientific name, have long argued that interaction with animals can soothe a troubled mind, but this claim has always been anecdotal, lacking the scientific data to back it up. Seeking to find out more, psychiatrists Christian Antonioli and Michael Ravelli at Britain's University of Leicester recruited 30 people in the US and Honduras who had been diagnosed with mild or moderate depression. The severity of their symptoms was calculated according to established yardsticks for mental health, which are based on interviews and questionnaires with the patient. The volunteers were required to stop taking any antidepressant drugs and psychotherapy for 4 weeks. Half of the group was then randomly selected to play, snorkel, and take care of dolphins each day at an Institute for Marine Sciences in Honduras. The other half was assigned to a program of outdoor activities, also at the Institute, that included swimming and snorkeling at a coral reef, but without the dolphins. 2 weeks later, both groups had improved, but especially so among patients who had been swimming with the dolphins. Measurable symptoms of depression in the dolphin group had fallen by half, and two-thirds according to the scales, twice as much as in the non-dolphin group. In addition, a self-rating measurement of anxiety symptoms, the Zung scale, found a fall of more than 20% among the dolphin group, compared with a decline of 11% among the non-dolphin groups. To the best of our knowledge, this is the first randomized, single-blind, controlled trial of animal-facilitated therapy with dolphins, Antonioli and Ravelli say. The effects exerted by the animals were significantly greater than those of just the natural setting. The echolocation system, the aesthetic value, and the emotions raised by the interaction with dolphins may explain the mammal's healing properties. It's these emotions, I believe, that are the key factor, as is demonstrated in this next story about how arguing with your partner can actually slow down healing. This from the Telegraph newspaper in the UK. They say rows can slow the body's natural ability to heal wounds. The stress felt by a married couple during a half-hour argument is enough to slow their body's ability to heal wounds by at least 1 day. If a couple argues repeatedly, this delay in the body's ability to heal can be doubled, according to a paper published yesterday in the Archives of General Psychiatry. The findings are the latest to emerge from experiments over 30 years at Ohio State University on the impact of stress on the ability to fight infection. Professor Jan Kaikoldt Glaser and her husband, Professor Ronald Glaser, said their findings had implications for people facing surgery. Doing something relaxing a day before surgery would be ideal, Professor Kaikoldt Glaser said. Stress reduction could lead to a shorter hospital stay with corresponding lower medical bills and a reduced risk of infections among patients, the study found. The team focused on 42 married couples who had been together an average of at least 12 years. They were given a blister on their arm so researchers could extract the fluid that naturally fills such small wounds. Couples who showed high levels of hostility needed 2 days longer for wound healing compared with couples whose hostility appeared low. Wounds on the hostile couples healed at only 60% of the rate of couples considered to have low levels of hostility. The fact that even this can bump the healing back a day for minor wounds says that wound healing is a really sensitive process. Next up, machines behaving like DNA? Find out more when Otherwear returns and discovers an interesting twist in the development of the latest nanotech robots. More about that in just 1 minute. If If you've never given it a second thought or even doubted it up until now, well, it seems that nature does indeed make the best technologies. And although you may think this sounds more like an exercise in speed dating, it's actually a process created by a team of researchers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Just like the biological components inside a cell can replicate a segment of DNA and self-correct when something goes out of whack, so too can a newly developed set of miniature robots. The 3-inch-long autonomous machines have mechanisms, both physical and computational, that allow them to meet up randomly, latch together, decide if they should stay connected, and then either let go or remain paired. The technique simultaneously addresses two of the most challenging requirements in nanoscale manufacturing: error-free assembly and massive parallel assembly of mechanical parts, said Robert A. Freitas Jr., a senior research fellow at the Institute for Molecular Manufacturing in Palo Alto, California, and co-author of a recent book on self-replicating machines. The new method, published by MIT's Joseph M. Jacobson in a recent edition of the journal Nature, could serve as the foundation for systems that assemble themselves, such as machines that break apart to explore tight places and then reassemble later. To date, self-replicating machines have been realized, but have relied on the well-ordered input of building blocks and do not possess a self-correcting function. But the approach taken by Jacobson and lead graduate student Saul Griffith functions more like a biological system. For example, inside a cell's nucleus, particles including a variety of chemical compounds and proteins float around randomly. The proteins copy bits of DNA by assembling the compounds into a specific order. This is not an assembly line where parts are delivered in the correct sequence, yet nature has figured out a way to correctly order the components and self-correct any errors along the way. We wanted to mimic nature and make an analogy to the machinery in nature that copies itself, said Jacobson. In the lab, his team built machines that come in two colours, yellow and green. They attached 5 robots together, shoulder to shoulder, to make a seed string, for example, green, green, yellow, yellow, green. The seed string, which served as the starting point for assembly, was placed on an air hockey table with a bunch of individual robots. Even though the robots in the string were attached shoulder to shoulder, the goal was to assemble identical rows of robots in the same color order, green, green, yellow, yellow, green. As the air from the table jostled the little machines here and there, they randomly bumped into each other as well as the components in the seed string. When they attached, they automatically sent each other an electronic signal to identify whether they were of the same color. If they were, they stayed together. If they weren't, they released. In tests, the team got perfect replication of the 5 robot strings each time. If they turned off the error correction program, however, strings replicated only 3% of the time. Jacobson and his team are now looking to miniaturize the system and build more complex strings that will take them a step closer to duplicating the sophistication found in nature. Continuing on with the wonders of nature, how about the thought that meditation makes your brain thicker? A study finds MRI images suggest mental exercises can increase your grey matter. People who meditate have thicker brains, according to scientists who believe that they have found the first structural evidence the popular mental exercise may increase all that grey matter in between your ears. Using magnetic resonance imaging, or MRI, Boston researchers found that parts of the brain important for attention and sensory processing, meaning how we take in and make sense of things, were thicker in meditators. While all were extensively experienced in Buddhist insight meditation, these are normal people with jobs and families who meditated, on average 40 minutes per day, said Dr. Jeremy Gray, assistant professor of psychology at Yale University and co-author of the study. You don't have to be a monk to see these changes in the actual structure of the brain. It's not like they grew a new chunk of the brain, Dr. Gray said. These were not huge differences, but they were statistically significant. The exciting part was that there was any difference at all. Supported by the US National Institute of Health, the Mind Institute, and the US Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the research is published in the journal Neuro Report. People who meditate report less stress, and scientists have linked long-term stress to shrinking of the part of the brain involved in memory and learning. The Boston scientists hypothesized that it might change the brain's actual physical structure too. Led by Dr. Sara Lazar of the Psychiatric Neuroimaging Research Program at Massachusetts General Hospital, the researchers measured cortical thickness in 20 people trained in Buddhist insight meditation, a popular form of the mental exercise that doesn't use mantra or chanting, but rather focuses on mindfulness, being aware of sensations, feelings, and state of mind. The average age was 38, and people had, on average, 9 years of meditation experience. Two were full-time meditation teachers. They were matched by age, gender, and education to 15 people who had never meditated or done yoga at all. MRI studies found parts of the cerebral cortex, the outer layer of the brain, were thicker in those who meditated. The biggest difference was in the insula, a part of the brain that is not so linked to higher cognition, but more to emotion and internal perception of body state, i.e. breathing, heart rate, or emotions. Changes in breathing rate, one of the effects of regular meditation, is a significant drop in respiration rate, were also related to thickness in one of the brain regions. They also found evidence the mental exercise might slow age-related thinning of the frontal cortex. Our initial results suggest that meditation may be associated with structural changes in areas of the brain that are important for sensory, cognitive, and emotional processing, the authors write in NeuroReport. The findings need to be validated by more extensive studies, but it's also possible that people with more cortical thickness are, for whatever reason, attracted to meditation to begin with. What's more, the researchers don't look at changes in the brain over time. However, Dr. Gray said that people who might otherwise be skeptical of meditation may now be more open to doing a meditation or stress reduction workshop on their lunchtime. Down here in Australia, the term meant by thick, or being a bit thick, is actually a bit slow. So as a lifelong meditator, perhaps the next time someone wants to tell me I've got a thick head, which in my earlier years was my mother, I'll just take that as a compliment. My mother Lily, incidentally, is celebrating her 60th birthday this week. So happy birthday, Mum. If it weren't for her driving me once a week to the radio station at 2 a.m. every Wednesday night for 6 whole months, until I got a better time slot to my first radio gig back in the late 80s, when I should have been sleeping for school the next day, I probably wouldn't be here right now. You're an amazing lady. And Mum, thanks for all the fish. That's an in-joke for all the dolphins out there. BBS Radio.
Downloading. Otherware.
After our interview with Dr. Fred Alan Wolf last week, I hope some of you out there have been cogitating on the nature of time. I think about it a lot, and lately I've had to remind myself by using the affirmation, there's more than enough time, quite a lot, to try to combat this feeling I've been having that things are just taking longer to do than they used to. Am I getting old, or is there something to it? Here's a story those forward-thinking souls at avantnews.com remote viewed from the future, November 29, 2010 to be precise, that could just help explain exactly what is going on. Do simple things like tying your shoes, brushing your teeth, or sitting through someone else's wedding seem to take longer than they once did? Do you generally wake up in the morning feeling cranky and bleary-eyed rather than refreshed and well-rested? Do vacations seem to flit by like a millisecond-long, scarcely-remembered dream? A new study by the Society of Unaffiliated Local Chronographers, or SULC, an international union of scientists who are paid by the hour to study time, find that many of these seeming inconsistencies can be explained by the fact that time itself is accelerating at an alarming and increasing rate. According to Dr. Herbert Tiktok, president of SULC and a leading investigator into what the union calls universal time inflation, time has been accelerating since the beginning of recorded, time. The root causes of the acceleration of time are not well established yet, although we think it may have to do with the possible contraction of space, a potential reversal of the Big Bang effect. If the universe were to contract at an increasing rate, time would accelerate along with it. We can't verify this possibility with any instruments at our disposal at this time, unfortunately, and if it's correct, the amount of time we have left to confirm it is shrinking too. Dr. TikTok said that time's acceleration explains a large number of otherwise inexplicable phenomena that have confounded historians and behavioural anthropologists for decades. One of the first and perhaps most everyday behavioural issues we were able to explain with the time inflation hypothesis, Dr. TikTok said, is the bewilderingly slow pace of the elderly when driving, trying on hats, relating anecdotes, and baking. The simple fact is that for someone, Grandpa for instance, who is 80 years of age, time has been accelerating for four times as long as for someone who is only 20. The resulting temporal relativity, he continued, when, for example, the elder party attempts to perform a task that would be accomplished much more quickly by the younger party, is in reality a simple side effect of the changing shape of the universe. Other phenomena explained by the TikTok time inflation theory are summer and winter vacations that seem to last years when one was a child, but now seem to blip by in seconds, the inflationary influence time exerts on international currency markets due to the time is money axiom, and the rapid flight of time when experiencing enjoyable activities. Paradoxically, converse effects, that is, the pleasant activities seem to go very quickly, while unpleasant activities take what seem like a very long time, are explained by the effect of heightened serotonin production in the brain, which creates an internal temporal magnetic field that warps space-time within a highly localized subjectivity matrix. Time's acceleration also explains the remarkable productivity of some of the greatest artists, scientists, and musicians in history. Shakespeare's entire body of work was written in less than 30 years, Dr. TikTok said. Leonardo da Vinci's fantastic spectrum of achievement in arts and sciences was accomplished in only 50. Mozart was only 35 when he died, but look at the enormous opus he left behind. The only explanation for this kind of superhuman prolificacy is that time during their respective centuries moved much, much slower than it does now. With the current pace of time, Dr. TikTok added, it's no surprise that hardly anyone ever produces anything of lasting value anymore. There simply isn't time. Because of the inflation of time, Western lifespans today, which when measured in years, are significantly longer than they were a mere 100 years ago, and are actually much shorter. You clock a larger number of years, but each year contains approximately 46% less time than it did a century ago. From that perspective, a man who dies at the age of 90 has actually lived roughly 10% less than someone who died at the age of 40 in the year 1910. According to Dr. TikTok, the only antidote to time inflation is, I'm afraid, misery. It's not much fun, but it does slow things down. And finally, here is one of the most exciting stories this week. For those of you out there who are fans of hidden archaeology and or the ancient Maya. For the better part of 100 years, mainstream archaeologists have been telling the world that the classic period of the Mayan civilization began around 300 AD and lasted until around 850 AD. But people in the know have more recently seen evidence that they were actually around much, much earlier. And now in this latest discovery of a Mayan treasure in the jungles of Guatemala, archaeologists say they have uncovered one of the most spectacular pieces of artwork created by the ancient Mayans ever. Archaeologist William Saturno said that it was like finding the Mayan equivalent of the Vatican's Sistine Chapel, and it's turning people's traditional ideas of the Maya on their heads. They have discovered a mural depicting the Mayan creation myth and the coronation of a king thought to be more than 2,000 years old, which was discovered at the San Bartolo site in northern Guatemala. Mr. Saturno of the University of New Hampshire said that the mural, measuring 3 by 30 feet wide, includes four deities which are variations on the same figure, a son of the maize god offering a blood sacrifice from his genitals. The first deity stands in the water and offers a fish, establishing a watery underworld. The second stands on the ground and sacrifices a deer, establishing the land. The third floats in the air, offering a turkey to establish the sky, and the fourth stands in a field of flowers, the food of gods, establishing paradise. The crowned Mayan king is depicted at the end of the mural. It was like discovering the Sistine Chapel if you didn't know there had been a Renaissance, Mr. Saturno said at a news conference recently. It's like knowing only modern art and then stumbling on the finger of God, touching the hand of Adam. Archaeologists say the artwork is particularly unique because it dates from hundreds of years before the classical Mayan period. The Mayans, known for their prowess in astronomy and mathematics, dominated southern Mexico and parts of Central America. The mural and William Saturno's research will be featured in the January issue of National Geographic magazine. If you'd like to see a picture of the image of the mural or find out any more about the stories that I've mentioned tonight on the show, then you can go to my blog at www.otherwhere.blogspot.com or follow the link from my bio page at bbsradio.com. Next on Otherwhere, we are crossing live to our roving reporter Eric McIntosh and passionate devotee of consciousness research, who is in Vancouver, Canada. We'll have a chance to get to know Eric a little better, and then joining us later in the show, we welcome none other than Alfred Weber, exopolitics expert and co-creator of peaceinspace.com.
I'm just about to welcome our wonderful newest roving reporter and member of the Otherwhere team to the show. One of the most exciting developments that I believe has occurred in our times is the advent of the new generation of Indigo Kids. By now, most of you have probably heard the term as the research done by authors like Doreen Virtue and others such as Lee Carroll, Jan Tober, Drumvalo Melchizedek and PMH Atwater have been slowly going mainstream. And in November, CNN News did their first story on Indigo Kids ever. Films and documentaries such as Indigo and Indigo Revolution have also been released worldwide. In the new year, I'll be spending a whole show focusing on these gifted children, but briefly, these special kids being born onto the planet started with small groups incarnating in waves from the early 1900s, increasing in the 60s, and the biggest group have been coming in since the early 80s. And Otherwhere's newest team member and roving reporter, Eric McIntosh, was born in 1982, on Christmas Day, no less. And from the interactions I've had with him since we started corresponding earlier this year, it became very obvious to me that I was interacting with an indigo who is now reaching maturity. It's encouraging to see the light shine brighter every time there is mass exposure to this phenomenon. And it's one thing to read about indigo kids or see them on the screen, but I'm much more interested in talking to them directly, as I think you will be too. And I think that once you meet Eric, you'll understand why. So let's cross live now to Vancouver Island in British Columbia, Canada, and welcome Eric to the show. Hi, Eric. It's great to have you join the Otherwhere team. Thanks so much for being here.
Well, thank you, Liz. It's a pleasure. And
tell
I'm
me,
actually coming
sorry.
From Vancouver, not Vancouver Island, but close enough.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about you and about some of the stories and upcoming guests you'll be bringing to the show.
Yeah, well, my first guest is Alfred Weber today. Of course, Alfred is the International Director for the Institute for Cooperation in Space. Later, probably in January, February, I'll be going into new energy, and I'll be discussing zero-point energy with some people from the new energy movement. And we'll be exploring a little bit about crop circles, remote viewing, and, of course, the whole phenomenon of the indigo children and maybe what's called today the crystal children, just to name a few.
Well, let's talk a little bit really quickly about indigo children. They're very highly evolved souls, and Doreen Virtue writes that they have a warrior spirit because their collective purpose is to mash down old systems that no longer serve us. And, that's one of the reasons why you're on the show too. They're here to quash government, educational and legal systems that lack integrity. And to accomplish this end, they need tempers and fiery determination, which often gets them misdiagnosed with ADD or ADHD and put on medication by adults around them who resist change and who value conformity. Now, something like that happened to you in your childhood, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. When I was about 5 years old, I was diagnosed with ADD. They put me on Ritalin, of course, but that didn't help the case. About 6 months later, that diagnosis, Tourette syndrome was pretty new in the early 90s, and I was living in Ottawa, Canada, where there was only one doctor in town who was looking at some of these Tourette syndrome cases that a lot of doctors in the United States were talking about. And so I started working with this doctor in Tourette syndrome, and that was basically the diagnosis for the remainder 4, 5, 6 years until I hit around 10, 11 years old. And at that point, what happened is I started getting introduced to Eastern medicine, and notably acupuncture, thanks to my mom. And I went to some acupuncture sessions for about 2 years. And by the time I was 12, I didn't have any more tics. My behavior, so quote unquote, was a little more accepted. And, of course, I was making friends, and it seems that I was more confident about who I was and, you know, my passions in life for pursuing them.
And so, since then, what are some of those passions?
Well, since then, I've had quite a few different passions. traveling is by far my favorite thing. I haven't had the chance to go to too many places, but recently I was in Sedona in Arizona. I did a shamanic dream journey, and that was very life-affirming for me. I like to go to the spots less discovered, and hopefully I'll be going to South America soon. And other than that, I've really been drawn to mostly the alternative news, quote unquote, that is happening around the globe. And I've been really focused on the spiritual transformation of the planet and seeing what technologies exist so to facilitate the change and the transformation in the systems that exist, our education, economic, government, etc. So I've been, you know, getting my feet wet in a lot of different subjects, but I would have to say that from all the exposure that exists, it seems that there is a massive influx, or at least interest, from all sides, taking a lot of these issues seriously. And now we are having, you know, more people in the higher echelons of our business and government bodies who are addressing some of these, quote-unquote, spiritual issues, so that we have a better way of dealing with this acceleration in time, where we are becoming aware that as citizens of this planet, we are also citizens of a universe full of different planets and different species. And that has really been my interest. And this is what I will be sharing with you on this marvelous show.
Well, I'm definitely looking forward to it, and I'm sure that there are many people out there as well who are looking forward to what you'll be bringing us. Ironically, Alfred Weber, your first guest, who will be appearing in the show in just a few minutes, is from your part of the world. I'm really looking forward to what he'll be chatting to us about. How did you come to know about Alfred's work with Exopolitics?
It started in January of this year. What happened is that I ended up at an open house meeting in Victoria, Canada, which is actually on Vancouver Island. This was hosted by Dr. Keith Martin, who's a member of Parliament in Victoria. And one of the main themes was missile defense. And on the specific subject, I got to hear about the work of Alfred Weber and his vision of banning space weapons, and by basically putting a cap on this war industry. And so it was encouraging to hear Dr. Martin, the Member of Parliament, say that he was going to bring this subject to our Canadian government and basically present a solution to put forth an international ban of space-based weapons. So I got to follow a little bit of Alfred's work since then, and just recently in September, his book, Exopolitics, has been highly recommended by our one former National Defense Minister, Paul Hellyer, at the Exopolitics Symposium in Toronto.
Yes, and Paul Hellyer's comments were really quite controversial. He said the U.S. states military are preparing weapons which could be used against the aliens, and they could get us into an intergalactic war without us ever having been warned. The Bush administration has finally agreed to let the military build a forward base on the moon, and that's something that I'll be looking forward to hearing Alfred and you discuss. So when we return, I'll be handing the show over to Eric, As we bring Alfred Weber to the phone lines to discuss the implications of Mr. Paul Hellyer's comments and, of course, find out exactly what exopolitics means. Back in just a couple of minutes.
Downloading. Otherware.
And welcome back. Today I would like to introduce my first guest, Alfred Weber. Going back to 1977, Mr. Weber was principal investigator behind the proposed Carter White House extraterrestrial communication study while working at Stanford Research Institute. In 2000, he was a presenter at the Presidential Forum on Off-Planet Cultures Policy at the Santa Clara Convention Center in California. And today, he is the International Director for the Institute for Cooperation in Space. The Institute is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to prevent the weaponization of space and promote the transformation of the war economy into a peaceful, cooperative space exploration industry. Through the help of Congressman Dennis Kucinich, the Space Preservation Act was introduced to the United States Congress on January 23, 2002, and more recently, Mr. Weber's book, Exopolitics, Politics, Government, and the Law in the Universe, was highly recommended by our former Canadian Minister of Defense and Deputy Prime Minister, Paul Hellyer, while speaking at the Toronto Exopolitics Symposium last September. So to discuss more about exopolitics, here is Alfred Weber. Alfred, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Well, I'm very happy to be here with you and with the listening audience, and I'm looking forward to bridging out and talking more about the nature of exopolitics and its role in our lifetime, really.
Now, before we get into exopolitics, my first question is, where did the term exopolitics come from?
Well, that's very interesting. I'm sitting here holding a copy of the book Exopolitics, and I would really urge your listeners, because it's a new discipline and a new field, and one that is a bridge or a doorway from our conventional terrestrial view of things to a view of the universe as highly populated. That term, as far as I know, I eventuated and wrote the book Exopolitics to define the field. And I wrote that in Vancouver, British Columbia, in Kitsilano Beach, in the years 1998 and 1999. And I first put it out free on the internet as a concept, not only as a word, but as a field, and that, and and as a point of view, as a way of looking at reality. And what exopolitics means is not what our 20th century science meant, and that is, which looked at all intelligent life in the universe ending at Earth's geostationary orbit, but rather that term which I had the privilege of bringing into being, really means an understanding, acceptance, internalization, and awareness that we on Earth live inside of a populated universe, which is populated by intelligent civilizations, inside an ecology of dimensions, which operate under international, some form of universal laws, which have some form of governance systems. And our planet and our culture Earth is part of this universe ecology and is now only now coming into awareness of it. So that's a way of answering your question. It came into being just at the end of the 20th century because we needed it in the 21st century.
Right. Wow. And today, when we address our terrestrial politics with, you know, the exopolitics, what is the response from the United Nations or any governmental body thus far regarding the issue of space weaponization and the peaceful mandates that are set forth by your organization?
Wow, Eric, that is a multi-level question. Let me see if I can unlayer a lot of the various layers there. You mentioned the organization United Nations, so I'm going to start there. Coincidentally, I was on the telephone this past Friday, which must have been, but December, today we're Saturday. Do you know what today is? December 17th?
Yeah.
I was on the phone yesterday, December 16th, with the Office of the President of the General Assembly of the United Nations, Mr. Jan Eliasson from Sweden. And we had occasion there to bring together and fuse those two concepts, the concept of preventing the weaponization of space and maintaining space as a universal commons of humankind, and also opening up our space and our planet to outreach and communication and scientific and public information about our place in a populated universe. Now, if we go every year at the United Nations General Assembly, there's an annual vote on whether or not there should be a treaty, an international treaty, banning the weaponization of space, banning space-based weapons and weapons in space. And inevitably, every year, that vote is typically, for example, in 2003, it was 174-0, with two or three abstentions. So that the overwhelming community of nations wants to ban weapons in space. There are only two nations that consistently abstain, which means that they vote against it, and they use all of the bureaucracy to stop that. Those two nations are the United States of America and Israel, both of which, for their own reasons, are intent on weaponizing space, and apparently intent on continuing an undeclared war against universe society. Now, the United Nations General Assembly itself went on record in December 1978 and approved a United Nations General Assembly resolution calling upon all UN member nations. Right now there are 191 UN member nations. Then there were, you know, whatever the equivalent amount was, but calling upon UN member nations to carry out programs of research into what they call, quote, extraterrestrial life. And that was a resolution brought in the same year that U.S. President Jimmy Carter, who himself was had a close encounter of the first kind in 1969 while he was running for governor of Georgia in the U.S. And that was brought by Sir Eric Gehry, who was Prime Minister of Grenada, who himself also had close encounters of the first kind with unidentified flying objects. And he brought that to the United Nations, and it was approved by the UN General Assembly. So yesterday, Friday, December 16th, we as an international non-governmental organization and a co-sponsor of the World Peace Forum 2006 to be held between June 23rd and June 28th, 2006, in Vancouver, filed with the office of the President of the UN General Assembly two documents. One document was a petition which has been signed by more than 3,700 leaders and activists in the world peace movement, calling upon the United Nations General Assembly to hold a space preservation treaty conference to ban all weapons in space, in the same way that Canada in 1997 held a treaty conference to ban all landmines. And secondly, we filed with the Office of the President of the UN General Assembly a United Nations General Assembly resolution calling for four things. We call it the UN United Nations Decade of Contact. And that resolution would do four things. We call it the four Ds. Number one, it would have the UN and its member nations engage in disclosure, that is official, transparent disclosure of an extraterrestrial presence, which we know that most leading world governments have been tracking now since the 1940s. The government of Brazil, just this year, its Air Force released all of its extraterrestrial tracking traffic, which it called hotel traffic, earlier in the spring of this year to certain civilian exopolitics groups. So the first thing that we called on was disclosure. The second thing that we called on for was a decade of contact, and that is for the UN General Assembly to approve and to ask all member nations to carry out and to fund a 10-year period of public funds devoted toward scientific research, public information, community activity, educational curricula, changing our entire culture around to accept that we live in a populated universe. In other words, to move away from the artificial information quarantine and embargo that we've had over the last 60 years. So that's the second D. The third D that we called on was disarmament. And that is a space preservation. The UN General Assembly would hold a space preservation treaty conference to ban all weapons in space. And the fourth D that we called for was diplomacy. And that is the United Nations would begin public interest diplomacy with advanced ethical off-planet cultures that are now engaging Earth and want to interact with us in a peaceful, mutually beneficial way, and in which universe and galactic governance authorities, such as a galactic council, whose existence has been demonstrated by replicable scientific remote viewing, has encouraged. So, in a way, Eric, I'm reporting on giving you a scoop here on the radio program that yesterday we filed the United Nations Decade of Contact resolution directly with the President of the United Nations General Assembly, as well as a petition signed by more than 3,700 leaders and activists in the world peace movement.
Wow, and that's a wonderful progress coming from the United Nations, and it's groundbreaking when we have two countries that are opposed, such as, well, the United States and Israel. Inside, you know, the United States and in Israel, there are numerous organizations that are trying to, you know, lift the cap of secrecy on this whole phenomenon. Now, when we come back after the short musical break, I'd like to talk a little bit about more of the representation coming from other civilizations and contact that we have with other civilizations. And so when we come back, I will welcome back Liz, and she'll ask a few more questions about this, and we'll stay tuned. We'll be right back.
If you've just tuned in, we're back on BBS Radio with renowned author and international director of the Institute for Cooperation in Space, based in Canada. Alfred Weber's book, Exopolitics, Politics, Government and Law in the Universe, is the evolution of his groundbreaking work as a futurist at the Stanford Research Institute, where in 1977 he directed a proposed extraterrestrial communication study project for the Carter White House. Alfred, welcome to the show. Thank you very much for that first segment with Eric. That was fantastic. I must say, it's a relief for many researchers into the UFO and ET phenomenon to see credible and well-respected people like yourself and Paul Hellyer standing up and speaking their truth on this subject. Who are some of the other people in positions of influence who have recently come forward to talk about this as well?
Well, that's a very interesting question. In a way, what has happened, and one of the most significant developments that has happened, is not so much the people that have stepped forward, but a new application of an existing discipline that was first developed by the U.S. Department of Defense and the Central Intelligence Agency as a terrestrial espionage tool, namely remote viewing, which was developed at Stanford Research Institute while I was there as a futurist by Dr. Puthoff and Russell Targ. And that tool, developed in the mid-70s to provide espionage in a Cold War context, was applied in the late 1980s and the early 1990s by U.S. Department of Defense and CIA-trained scientific remote viewers. And what that means, for those of your audience who may not be totally aware of the application of a replicable scientific protocol leading to replicable results under consistent laboratory protocols, what that has developed is lengthy contact and lengthy transcripts of observation, communication, and interaction between trained remote viewers and representatives of off-planet cultures, and trained remote viewers and representatives of galactic governance authorities. So that some of the most surprising people have actually come forward in public. For example, Major General Albert Stubblebine, who was chief of U.S. Army intelligence, has revealed that scientific remote viewers within the U.S. Army, who are members of U.S. Army intelligence, were routinely remote viewing the comings and goings of an apparent intelligent civilization under the surface of Mars. So one of the more significant developments has been the transform application of technologies that were developed for military intelligence surveillance to open communication with off-planet cultures. And it's that application which has led to the development and the growth of the exopolitics model.
In terms of universal contact, one of the purposes of this show isn't to try to demonstrate that UFOs and intelligence from other parts of the galaxy and beyond exist, and I think it's pretty clear what you've just said, that it definitely does. But it's to try to examine who they are, where they are, and how we may establish further contact with them. Can you tell us a little bit about any of the identifiable extraterrestrial or extra-dimensional races that have already been interacting with our governments and the remote viewers that you mentioned earlier?
Well, yes, that's a fascinating question, and it's an issue that was part of the Honorable Paul Hellyer's and our non-governmental organization's submission to the Canadian Senate earlier this year, and part of our submission now to the General Assembly of the UN. For example, and I'm glad you used the word interdimensional, because what our science, through remote viewing and through string theory, is beginning to demonstrate is what many of the mystics and esoteric researchers have said, and that we live within a dimensional universe. And so within that kind of cosmology, the terminology has developed that what we humans live in our terrestrial reality, is what we could loosely term the third, lower, fourth dimension. And that is that what we know is time and space, that kind of fourth dimensional reality is this material reality that is most, we know is mostly empty space, but we can knock on the walls and we can touch the furniture around the room and we can see our own bodies and other bodies in the sky and the stars and this sort of material reality. And we also have access to immediately what the esotericists would call the astral dimensions, or the religionists would call heaven and hell. So we're within a very our deeper consciousnesses, what parapsychology has determined is the deeper consciousness of human beings or the soul. Apparently, has access to at least a two layers of reality in this dimension. Well, now, what we're learning through remote viewing is fascinating, because we're learning that there very well may be an intelligent civilization under the surface of Mars. And I'll just limit it to that, because there are many, many other civilizations out there that we're beginning to discover. But what's interesting about the civilization under Mars, according to the remote viewing, is that they seem to exist in our sort of third/fourth dimension reality. And they are about, according to the remote viewing data, about 150 years technologically in advance of our own civilization. And apparently, in eons past, we don't know exactly how far back, perhaps a couple of million years ago, there was an enormous, some say, solar system cataclysm, but at least a catastrophe that impacted Mars greatly, and it lost its atmosphere, it lost its surface light. It was once a verdant planet like Earth. In fact, it may have been that our solar system was once a thriving, living, verdant planet, verdant solar system, that the asteroids were in fact once a populated planet. What appears to have occurred, according to remote viewing data, is that after this catastrophe took place, the Martian civilization that is living on Mars now is actually the survivors of this. And there is, in our highly evolved and organized galaxy, various races that act almost as the Galactic Red Cross, much like the International Red Cross, one called the Advanced Greys. And according to remote viewing data, the Advanced Greys were under the authority of the Galactic Federation, were sent to the rescue of this Martian race, and they have time-space travel, both time travel capability and space travel capability, which we're beginning to find out that space travel is time travel, because that's the only way you can get across these vast distances. So that the present-day Martians were actually rescued several million years ago, or some indeterminate time ago, and brought forward in time to the present day. The Martians are peaceful. There are no world wars or wars going on Mars. There are about 150 wars going on our planet at any single point in time. And the Martians exist by a secrecy. That's their principal defensive mode. Well, they have, according to the data, have already established some colonies on Earth. They're very much both Martians and humans, apparently, are of the same. We're genetic cousins. And what the galactic authorities have said is that it would be a great mutual benefit both to Martians and to terrestrials, our earthly society, if we were to establish formal communications and diplomatic relations and allow some form of a migration from Mars to Earth, because it's very difficult to live under those conditions. And also, it would be beneficial to us to get out of sort of our planetary autism and humanity's fixation with a permanent warfare state. So this is the initial proposal in the form of the Star Dreams initiative that we've put forth to the United Nations. This is all set out at www.peaceinspace.net, a lot of the background there. And I would also urge your listeners who may want to, not because of pride of authorship, but because this is genuinely new knowledge, to think about reading the book Exopolitics, Politics, Government, and Law in the Universe. There's a very, very in-depth information and resource website at www.exopolitics.com and at universebooks.com. All of this knowledge is coming about what we call just in time. That is, we humans may be on the verge of blowing ourselves up and or of having to cope with a new ice age through global warming and through galactic processes that may be coming around the year 2012 or starting then. So we're at a very crucial time in our evolution.
I'd like to talk a little bit more with you, if we could, about the Galactic Federation and whether or not members of them are actually interacting with us here on Earth right now.
Well, that's a very interesting subject, because from what we can tell from the remote viewing data, the again, we live inside of an ecology of dimensions, and for example, some of the data of from telepathic contactees, and this has yet to be verified, demonstrates that civilizations within our own galaxy are visiting us. More advanced civilization on the order of millions to a billion or more years in advance of our own, who are inside of what would be called a fixed sixth dimension civilization. And those dimensions are dimensions that exist what they would call, those are civilizations that are based on love and light. Love and light as twin principles inside the universe. We're just beginning to discover the true nature of light. And we're just beginning to discover the universal force of agape, or cosmic love. And apparently, as civilizations evolve, they discover that we live inside what we can call the plenum, which is a kind of a universal light field. And the more closely we examine that field, the more it appears to have the properties of source. Well, the Galactic Federation, in a way, you can't get there from here, because they're very evolved and they're in other dimensions. They're in higher dimensions, and they too are subject to universal laws, laws of cause and effect, laws of non-interference, laws of the decentralization of creation. And from what we can tell, this is why we're calling for a decade of contact, so that we can begin to accept that we're inside of a populated universe and begin to devote public funds towards scientific research and education about this, so that we can begin to discover exactly what are the basic laws that govern the relationships of galactic governance authorities to our own reality. It's not that the galactic governance authorities of the Galactic Federation, as far as we can determine, it's not as though we could easily send representatives from here to there, because there may well be in a more refined dimension of the universe. However, we can send the consciousnesses through the technology of remote viewing, in which the scientific remote viewer, the trained remote viewer, using standard laboratory protocols, goes, in a sense, outside of the time-space continuum to what they call a subspace, where there's a soul-to-soul or essence-to-essence communication. And you're going from point A, B, C, D in a time-space continuum to point E, F, Y, G, in almost outside of the time-space continuum. And what remote viewing does is that it allows the playing field, it allows a level playing field between civilizations and consciousnesses in a third, fourth dimension as our own, and say, a governance body that is composed of representatives in the ninth dimension, supposedly, which is the dimension of Unan Kub, which is the galactic center. And we know that in 2002, human science has discovered that there is a black hole in the center of the galaxy. We're truly in the era of the unification of science and spirituality, and it well may be that galactic governance and universal governance is in that point where science, spirituality, and social and political relationships meet, and that's the whole new field of exopolitics.
It's absolutely fascinating. But I guess before we can really get there, the bureaucracy needs to get past a kind of annoying hurdle of announcing that we're actually not alone in the universe, and that Earth has been visited in the distant past it's being visited now in the present and will continue to be in the future. There's a saying that when the pupil is ready, the teacher will appear. And in a study called the Zoo Hypothesis, it stated that for first contact to actually occur, a certain level of consciousness needs to be present here on Earth for that to happen. Do you think we're ready for it?
A key question. All of the evidence would seem to indicate that we are. If one looks at objective measures of human attitudes, for example, the 2002 Roper poll, that poll demonstrates that depending on how you ask the question and what specific question you ask, between 45 and 85% of respondents, now those respondents were North American, were residents of the U.S., presumably it would apply along some similar scale to residents of North America, to residents of Europe, Asia, South Pacific, and other regions of the planet. But according to these objective polls, which reflect earlier polls, for example, the 1998 Gallup poll, which found the same thing, between 45 and 85% of respondents, depending on the question, are congruent with an extraterrestrial presence. It doesn't upset them at all. They say that, hey, you know, somewhere around 65 to 85% believe that extraterrestrials are visiting Earth. They said it would not surprise them a bit. They say that they know that the government is hiding an embargo and engaging in an information embargo, and that they would not find it at all shocking or in conflict with their religious or spiritual beliefs. So present human culture seems to be congruent with an extraterrestrial presence, and so that the UFO phenomenon, we have characterized in the mid-1970s, I developed a theory called the context communication theory of extraterrestrial communication, and that held that things like UFO encounters are in fact multidimensional communications from a higher intelligence to our own, much like dreams are a symbolic communication from the human subconscious to the human conscious. So the UFO phenomenon, which began in earnest after World War II, has successfully been able to awaken humanity through the psychological principles of peripheral cueing to our existence within a populated universe. Now, what have been the barriers to full human acceptance of the extraterrestrial presence? The more we delve into it, the conventional stereotype is that we are not ready. But I believe if we delve into it at a deep level and examine what occurred after World War II in terms of the twin forces that would help to explain why it is that the United States and Israel are the parties that are trying to promote the weaponization of space and promote a covert war between the Earth and universe society. And what we find there was that following World War II, when universe society made its outreach toward our society, there was a series of policies put into effect by the main spacefaring nation, the United States, which in effect, through various groups such as PI-40 and the study group, which were put into effect by Nelson Rockefeller, David Rockefeller, and their intellectual agent, Henry Kissinger, who was one of the architects of Project Paperclip, who brought the Nazi scientists of the Third Reich over to the United States to found both NASA and to found much of the modern mind control and permanent warfare state that exists in post-war America. And what occurred at that point in a demonstrated way, which is now on the record, is that the technology and contact with extraterrestrial civilizations, which began in earnest after the Roswell incident, in which extraterrestrial aircraft were recovered in 1947, that was privatized. And all of that technology was brought into Rockefeller and New World Order controlled corporations, so that technology was put to use to propel the permanent warfare economy, and also the profitability of the New World Order and Rockefeller-controlled corporate state. And in effect, the democratic processes, starting with the President of the United States, Eisenhower, and the Congress, and most of the democratic institutions, including the United Nations, were cut out of the loop. It was privatized. And so the entire information embargo from the terrestrial point of view was put to private profit and to the implementation of a very hierarchical elite hyper-capitalistic clique that whereby approximately 95% of the world's wealth is owned by the top 250 families. Well, that runs very counter to the values of advanced civilizations, of advanced civilizations within our galaxy that are visiting us now. So part of the breakthroughs, and this is where the Honorable Paul Hellyer, former Minister of Defense of Canada, has stepped forward, where over the next year to 5 to 10 years, we are now at the edge of a watershed of a major transformation in human civilization, in which we come out of our terrestrial bubble into becoming a galactically oriented and universally oriented civilization, in which the permanent war economy is deconstructed as it comes to the surface that the information embargo was really artificially imposed, and that we humans have been ready for galactic citizenship for at least 5 or 6 decades.
I agree completely. And it leads one to ask the question, why is there an embargo in the first place? Why do the, for want of a better term, the world management team want to keep people in the dark and create more fear about ET civilizations and extra-dimensional beings and prevent us from actually reaching that watershed?
Well, that's a key question. We can hypothesize why by going back to, in historical research, for example, the first United States organization that was put together to smuggle opium from India into China back in 1823. And the same individual who did that, Mr. Russell, founded the first chapter of the Order of Death, which was a secret society in in Germany, based on the Hegelian Illuminati organizations, which he founded at Yale University, under Skull and Bones, whose secret name is the Order of Death. And if you go back to 1832, the year in which that was founded, one finds that, in fact, all of the wars, the U.S. Civil War, World War I, World War II, were actually, and this is on the evidence, carried out by a secret network of individuals and families all connected through the Order of Death, on the one hand, such that we see absolute complete evidence, for example, that the entire Bolshevik Revolution in the Soviet Union was financed by Avril Harriman and the Union a Bank of Wall Street and Harriman and Company, that brought over U.S. dollar plates and entire factories, such that the Russian and communism could go forward, and such that down to the point where, for example, Henry Kissinger, when he was Director of National Security and U.S. Secretary of State, he approved the sale of the technology which allowed the Soviet missiles to be MIRV, to be put in with multiple independent reentry vehicles, so that, in fact, it has been the permanent war economy of the New World Order of the United States, which fueled the Soviet Union and communism to set up that polarity so as to set up the Cold War. Likewise, it is absolutely demonstrated by the evidence, and I'll show you Chris Milliken's latest book on Skull and Bones, that the Third Reich, that Germany, Nazi Germany, starting in 1923 with Adolf Hitler through Fritz Thyssen, was financed by Skull and Bones or the Order of Death, namely Prescott Bush, the current President George W. Bush's grandfather, actually financed Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party starting in 1923, and then through the World War actually not only financed but administered the Nazi death camps and the slave economy, so that you had Ford Motor Company, General Motors, etc., Woolworths and Company operating inside Germany at the same time, such that both communism and the Bolsheviks and fascism and Adolf Hitler were actually financed, and entire factories brought through, and the entire economy of them. This is all demonstrated historically with documents, were actually funded by the U.S.-based secret establishment based on the Order of Death, which was Skull and Bones. That this had to be suppressed so much during World War II that it was Prescott Bush, George W. Bush's grandfather, that was doing it, because it was thought at that time, if it was made public, the Allied troops would mutiny. And at the same time, there appears to have been a secret agreement going back to the 1780s, when the secret plan based on the Hegelian dialectic of what they call the New World Order, a plan to take over the world. There was a writer dispatched from Adam Weisskopf, who was developed in Vienna, who was sending it down to Paris. Fortunately, the writer carrying the document died, and the document was discovered. In fact, there was a book written on it, which was sent to George Washington, then President of the United States, who declared, yes, it's true, there are a number of these Illuminati Order of Death people in the United States now. That was during George Washington's first term. Well, it turns out that Henry Kissinger, as an agent of the Zionists, the secret Zionists that came down through the New World Order, through the Rothschilds, linked up in an historical nexus with Nelson and David Rockefeller. They ran the entire paperclip operation, which was to take Nazi scientists out of Germany, but it turns out that the Nazi scientists were really on the payroll of the Prescott Bush and the Avril Harriman organization. Nazism was just a creature of the Order of Death. So they just transferred all these scientists from the German office to the United States office after World War II. And Henry Kissinger and Nelson David Rockefeller amplify the sort of alliance between these two. Now, you might ask, why has this happened? Well, this goes back to a very deep exopolitical reality, which we want to discover more in this decade of contact, and that is, it appears as though our quadrant of the universe, our solar system, and our planet may be under some form of a universe quarantine, that is, some order. There may have been a severe disturbance which took place on our planet and our quadrant of the universe at some point, kind of a universal civil war, and we were placed under quarantine. And there are many, scientific remote viewing has gone back, for example, to look at the possible reality of historical events in our culture that are expressed in allegorically in sacred texts such as the Book of Genesis, the whole Adam and Eve story with Lucifer and Satan and all of this. And it well may be that there was a universe civil war on our planet, and some of the remote viewing tends to suggest that that may have been the case, and that there were, in effect, a renegade race of extraterrestrials that were colonizing this planet that broke away, and, you know, they're historical. They appear historically in the allegory of Adam and Eve as universal colonizers and Lucifer and Satan as the rebels. And it well may be that the remnants of those dimensional consciousnesses have been embedded in the fourth dimension, what they call the lower astrals or hell, of our third, fourth dimension civilization, and have been plaguing our culture over the last while. That, in fact, we're now at the culmination of that, and individuals in the New World Order, such as the Kissingers, such as the Bushes, where there's a demonstrated culture of pedophilia, of necrophilia, of Satanism, of ritual abuse, of mind control, all of this is on the record, that this is the end and the culmination of sort of the satanic occupation of our solar system. Let's hope that that's the case.
Let's hope it is. Alfred, would you mind if we held on to you for just a little bit longer and come back after the break with Eric once again?
Oh, great.
Fantastic. I'd love to ask you about your thoughts on when first contact might be occurring, as well as some more of your thoughts on the year 2012. So more about that with Alfred Weber when we return on BBS Radio and Otherwhere.
Online. Thank you.
we're back on BBS Radio. You're tuned in to Otherwhere with myself, Liz Miller, and my roving reporter is back with us, Eric McIntosh. Hi, are you there?
Hello.
Hello. And Alfred Weber, our guest, the director of the Institute for Cooperation in Space. And what an interview you've given us tonight. Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Eric, I think I'll throw to you now. Have you got anything you'd like to ask Alfred?
Well, I do, and I mean, just listening to all that you said, Alfred, it's really a multifaceted subject when it comes to exopolitics. Now, when we're dealing with our current political system in, you know, a very short period of time, when do you think this contact will be made, and with whom on planet Earth will it be made with?
Because of the earlier resolution passed by the United Nations General Assembly in 1978, you can say that that resolution was set down the authority under international law, terrestrial international law, for first contact. And we've had contact going through various programs, both a private scientist in the United States through U.S. Army intelligence carrying that forward. Well, let's see that we're now coming into 2006, and I wouldn't want to give an exact date because what it is our terrestrial here, ourselves, getting enough momentum in our civilization to push through where at the world level we can have these transparent programs going. And so it really is a matter of our focalizing and our really becoming focused on this. And I would urge all of your listeners to go to www.peaceinspace.net and begin communicating with the Parliament of Canada. We have all of the links there. Go also to exopolitics.com. Begin communicating with the Parliament of Canada. We have a program such that every candidate for U.S. federal office, so the U.S. midterm election in 2006 is taking place November 7th, 2006. We're going to ask them to take a public stand. There are 435 U.S. Congress people that are up. They're up for grabs. That seat, subject to election, and about one-third of the 100 U.S. senators. And we have the exopolitics platform, which is the four Ds of disclosure, executive contact, disarmament, and diplomacy, and see where they stand. And now we've opened up with the U.N., the United Nations General Assembly, the Office of the President. There are links there whereby you can sign petitions. Your name will go directly to the Office of the President of the United Nations General Assembly and to the United Nations. So that it really is a matter. We all have to become engaged in our body's politics and change this, because guess what? The time is now.
The time certainly is now, and we're moving closer and closer to the year 2012, which many people believe is going to be a time when we go into a no-time zone, when we actually transcend time or linear time as we know it now. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, there are two different aspects of it. Certain scientists, such as Dr. Paul Laviolette, have demonstrated that at one level, we live within a very volatile galaxy. Our Milky Way galaxy is almost like a large volcano. And the center of the galaxy, which is about 23,000 light years away in the constellation Sagittarius, that the center of the Milky Way galaxy erupts on a periodic basis, almost like a volcano. And of course, the Mayans had a special name for it, Unaycup. And apparently the center of the galaxy erupts on a various cycles. Some of these cycles are hundreds of billions of years old, but one of the periodicities is 13,000 and 26,000 years. And what occurs at this time is that galactic superwaves come out from the center of the galaxy, spewing gamma rays, spewing cosmic dust, tremendous amounts of energy that cause vast disruptions, such as in the last galactic cycle, which occurred 11,500 years ago, galactic superwave, there was an enormous species extinction on our planet, and it was apparently the time of the destruction of the Atlantean civilization. And so the 26,000-year cycle will come up and start occurring on that magical date of December 21st, 2012. That's when we start the high danger zone for galactic superwaves. And what Dr. LaViolette has demonstrated is that the Asian tsunami of Boxing Day, December 26, 2004, was actually due to the explosion of a neutron star 45,000 light years away in the constellation Sagittarius. The gamma ray outburst, the super wave, the gravity wave from that explosion reached Earth on December 26, 2004. The gamma rays reached a couple of days later, and it was those gravity waves that actually resulted in the tsunami, the earthquake and the tsunami, which was enormously destructive, most powerful earthquake in a century, which has actually changed the shape of the Earth. And from a prophetic standpoint, what some of the prophetic readings of that event say was that was in the Garabandal prophecies and the Fatima prophecies, quote, the final warning of humanity not moving away from the permanent warfare state. So our future is kind of in our collective. Now, what the Mayan prophecies say, the Mayan calendar, the end of one long count, kind of organic unit of time in the galactic calendar, the Mayan calendar, occurs at midnight on December 21st, 2012, and a new unit of kind of a new organic unit of time begins again. Some of the speculation, for example, Barbara Han Clow, who points out that we live in the nine-dimensional galaxy, that we humans are very, very special because we're one of the few beings in the galaxy that contain within ourselves all of the nine dimensions. And that at this time, what the Mayans say is that there are both Earth changes, but also vast increases in consciousness. And so there's a tremendous amount of speculation about what may be occurring. Barbara Han Clow, who's very imaginative, says that what will be occurring at that time is that we will be going through the black hole that has been discovered at the center of the galaxy, and that we humans have actually been chosen to populate a new universe that's on the other side of the black hole at the center of our galaxy. So we're going into a new heaven and a new earth, a new dimension.
Wow, that sounds just like The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Well, the new Earth's being created, and we're all going to move over there really soon.
Yeah. So these are at that end, that is some of the speculation. It is within our will, our collective human will, and our collective consciousness to really create the new heaven and the new earth, which seems to be coming.
Well, Alfred, with people like you were out there talking about these subjects and doing the amazing work that you are doing, I really hold on to the hope that we will make it and we will definitely get there. Eric, is there anything else that you'd like to ask Alfred before we go?
Well, there's so much that's been said. I really valued the interview today. We went into a lot of different spheres, and I think that it's pretty clear that with, you know, just the concept of exopolitics is, goes much deeper than what we originally expected. And I just wanted to actually repeat some of those links, Alfred, so we can get, you know, some of our listeners involved in this whole process. So there is a treaty, there's a treaty for the United Nations, and where can people go to find that?
Yes. You can go to www.peaceinspace.net, and you will find there all of the tools, including the treaty, including a link that you can, whereby you can put in your signature asking for a treaty conference to be held. And then there's an allied website, an information resource website of www.exopolitics.com. There's a tremendous amount of information and resources there. And then at universebooks.com, you can go and begin to access the book Exopolitics, which really provides the exopolitics model, which is our bridge out into the stars.
Wow. Well, it's just been amazing. So thank you both for appearing on the show tonight. We're nearly at the end of our time. It's just been a wonderful interview.
Thank you.
It was our pleasure. So stay tuned to BBS Radio, as when we come back, we'll be moving into the final part of the show with an extended half-hour journey into relaxation. And just one more time for that web address once again, peaceinspace.com. And Don, we're ready to cross over, and I'll say goodnight for now, and we'll be back with the relaxation.
You've enjoyed the show tonight, meeting Eric and spending some time exploring the possibility of first contact with Alfred Weber. As usual, we'll be ending our time together with a relaxation session, and tonight it will be an extended version, so make sure that the phone is turned off and that you won't be disturbed for the next half an hour. Of course, if you're driving a car or operating machinery, make sure that you come back to the meditation later. As you know, next week it's Christmas, so I'll be taking Otherwhere offline until the new year, when we return with more amazing guests such as Jean Manning, Fred Burks, Michelle Eloff and Joan Ocean, among others, and more multidimensional news from the front lines of the new energy and new thought movements. Before I go, I'd like to wish you, the Otherwhere audience, Don and everyone else here on the BBS Radio Network, a blessed Christmas season, and an even more powerful, transformative, and joyful new year. Exists in every human being a center which is never disturbed by external circumstances. This innermost natural state is the vibration of love in the soul of man. Whoever is able to relax so deeply as to contact soul level will experience an all-pervading sweetness, a state of no desire, complete peace and happiness. It is felt in every cell of the body, yet it is not of the body. It is being in the present, being part of all things, without separation, full of love for the whole world and an infinite understanding of it. This oneness permeates you and every atom in the universe. So please join me as we link up together at the heart and give thanks, especially at this time of year, and form the Otherwhere circle of lights. All you have to do is get comfortable, either sitting or lying down, but preferably lying down this week. Close your eyes and let my voice be your guide. And when you do relaxation, it is very good to condition yourself to realize that you do this with your own free will and that you want to make the best of it. You want to achieve the best results, so just for the moment, give some suggestions to yourself. Say, I will go as deep as I can, and I will go deeper today than I have ever been before, or something of that kind. Formulate it in your own way, but do it positively. It is always good to give orders to your subconscious because it does listen. And try to remember that the less you try to relax, the less you work at it, the easier it is. The more passive you can make yourself, the more you can follow my voice, my instructions, the more likely you are able to get to that borderline between sleeping and waking, which is very deep relaxation. Lie down and make sure that you're warm and comfortable, especially if it's cold where you are. But even if it isn't, your body's metabolism will slow down, so it's a really good idea to make sure that you've got something covering you. Now check that your spine is straight and aligned. And if you need to, lift your head up and look in between your feet. If you're looking straight ahead, then you know that your spine is straight. Now you should not move a hand, a foot, or even an eyelid. You should be completely still. As long as you move, you cannot really relax. Now check that your chin is inclined slightly in towards your chest, flattening out the back of the neck. Allow your shoulder blades to be squeezed together just a little bit to open up the chest, and then allow your arms to rest gently by your sides, a few inches away from them, with the palms turned up. Let the fingers curl gently, like a baby's, and feel your shoulder blades nestling down, lying flatly against the floor beneath you. Then allow your legs to be loosely flopped apart, your toes turned outwards, so that all of the muscles along your legs and arms are able to give in completely. And if you find yourself drifting over into sleep, don't fight it. It doesn't matter. You might not remember a few sentences have been said, but your subconscious will take it in just as well, and the benefits will be the same. And know that this next half an hour is your time. It's time that you've set aside in your week to help unwind your body and relieve your mind of some of the stresses that you accumulate in our busy everyday lives, and hopefully free up some space to allow more positive energy to come in. So let's begin. First of all, take your tongue and run it around your lips, softening and moistening them. Then let the tongue gently rest behind your lower teeth. Feel the jaw beginning to release, and allow your teeth to be gently parted, and your lips soft and easy. Then open your eyes and very lightly close them once more. Allow your eyes to sink down into their sockets as they grow heavier, and give them permission to give in. Right now, they don't need to work. Tell your whole body that you don't need to be anywhere else or doing anything else right now, and give it permission as well, so that it can completely release and let go. Feel a wonderful softness beginning to extend upwards and downwards from your jaw, upwards into the face and cheeks, as you feel all of the tiny muscles around your nose and eyes and forehead beginning to release and soften, growing plump, and for any of the tiny lines to smooth out so that your face becomes as smooth as porcelain. Be aware of your scalp, so that even the skin at the top of your head and down along the back of your neck also begins to grow easy, and that even the hair follicles begin to release any traces of tension they might be holding on to. The blood can freely circulate around them, nourishing your hair. As you feel this softness beginning to extend even further down into your body, feel a gentle smile on the edges of your mouth, so that the edges are turned upwards instead of downwards, and allow that smile to extend down into the rest of your body, so that it feels as though your whole body is gently smiling. And remind yourself that it is a good day. You're warm, peaceful, and very comfortable. And all you need to do right now is be. as you feel your eyes now resting very heavily and deep down into their sockets. Relax your eyelids. They are not pressed down. They do not flutter. They are closed gently and lightly, like the wings of butterflies, and the darkness behind your closed eyelids is peaceful, velvety, friendly. And you can feel the smile that started on your lips, even underneath your closed eyes. Relax your eyebrows. Feel them like two arches, one above each eye. Feel them as separate with a space in between. And recognize now how that space has flattened out. It's relaxed without a frown. Allow your forehead to also smooth out even more as you feel the skin on your forehead expanding in all directions, becoming broader and wider. Now move your awareness down the back of your neck. This is the part of our body which collects a lot of tension. It collects all our frustration and sometimes resentment during the day. All of these things seem to come together like a tight knot at the back of the neck until eventually you get what is called a pain in the neck. And it's a very real thing. So now allow it to dissolve. Feel that accumulated ball of tension releasing as you feel your neck becoming longer and straighter. Now feel the muscles between your neck and shoulders. Feel your shoulders expanding, spreading out, sinking down, as you allow your shoulder blades and the very top of your spine to nestle even deeper into the support underneath you. Take your mind very slowly down all the way through the vertebrae, down into the small of your back and the base of your spine, as you feel it becoming longer and flatter, losing all tension, all pain. Then take your mind within and draw your senses inwards, up to the top, this time to your right shoulder, and use it like a flat hand to gently stroke down the right side of your back, the way that you would stroke the fur of an animal. And as you move slowly down the right side of your back, you feel all the muscles, the fibers, and nerve endings flattening, smoothing, losing any tension that may be there. Take your mind now to the left shoulder, and once again, use it in a broad sweep, and sweep your mind down the left side of your back, again, flattening it out, feeling the nerve endings smoothing, releasing. And as you feel every point of contact that your back has against the floor underneath you, or the bed, enjoy that feeling of support, giving into it more and more, knowing that you can allow your body to become as heavy as it wants to be. Now relax your pelvis and buttocks. Feel your hip bones expanding as you allow your hips to give in. Be aware of your waist and your tummy also releasing, becoming broader and wider. Without restriction, without pressure, resting easily, without any discomfort or pain. Now draw your awareness into your right arm as you feel the upper arm, the elbow, forearm, and wrist. Let go. Your left arm, again from the upper arm to the elbow, forearm, and wrist, giving in. And both of your hands resting so heavily against the support beneath you, so that your arms are just like weights resting on either side of your body, so that even if you wanted to, you couldn't even lift a finger. Now draw your awareness down into your legs and notice just how heavy they have also become. Big thigh muscles giving in and letting go. Backs of the knees, release. Calves, ankles, feet, toes. Let go. And now if you run your awareness through your entire body, you'll know it has given in, released deep down into the relaxation. Now become aware of how much your senses have withdrawn into your body. Consciously withdraw your sense of smell into the middle of your brain. Your eyesight has already withdrawn, with your eyes closed, resting deep in their sockets. Then withdraw your sense of touch from everywhere over your body, turning it inwards, so that now you're feeling the inside of your body and not the surface. Then withdraw your sense of hearing, feeling all noises and all distractions fading away. As you inhale deeply now, draw in a long breath. And as you exhale, feel yourself sinking deeper and deeper into a quiet space within. Feel that space in the center of your chest as you allow yourself to connect with your heart and with everybody else's heart in our circle of light. As you feel it slowly opening, allowing yourself to become aware of any feelings, any sensations that help you connect with everybody else in our circle. Begin to visualize once again the web of love that circles our planet and connects each of us at our deepest essence. Allowing your breath to gently and rhythmically flow in and out of your body. As you focus on the web of love and you become more aware of the rhythm of your breath, know that we can use this rhythm to find strength, stability, and harmony right within ourselves without outside agency. So continue to concentrate on the rhythm of your own breathing. Feel yourself gently rock by the movement of your chest, like a child in a cradle, finding in this movement comfort and peace. Then realize that your own rhythm, your own harmony, is a very small part within a larger rhythm, within a larger harmony, that you and yourself are a very important part of a larger unit, whether this unit is your family, or your place of work, or simply the people you come in touch with throughout the day. The more balanced, the stronger you are within yourself, the more you are able to be a building block, a connecting link with everything around you. You are like a single stitch within a knitted fabric. The importance of your life can only be assessed in relation to your connecting power between that which went before and that which is to come. You will find that when you look on your life in this light, it is so simplified. It becomes much easier to be both resilient and active within your chosen or given field of activity. So continue to move in rhythm with the web of love and your own breathing. Immerse yourself, your whole being, in that rhythm, and all the time feel yourself expanding and relaxing more and more in all directions until you lose all sense of shape and the boundaries of your physical body, so that you become like a large sphere full of light, peaceful and still and self-contained. With each in-breath, know that the heart energy of those in the web of love is flowing into you. And as it does, connect once again with that light at your heart and feel it growing and expanding, filling every part of your being. And with each out-breath, allow that light to be sent to all of the other hearts in our web of love, your sacred love flowing out, touching each heart in our circle. For a few moments, allow yourself to stay with this image. And as you do, recognize the light expanding more and more. And know that that light is made up of love. And as we move into the quietness, I'd like you to imagine all of the love that you've ever received in your life, from the moment of your conception until today. Allow it to flow in towards you as if it were coming to you all at once in this moment. And then, in your mind's eye, see yourself look out at your hands, and in them you find yourself holding a beautiful diamond, polished, shining brilliantly, reflecting and radiating light from all of the facets. Hold it up to the light and recognize this diamond is your multidimensional self. It has many facets, each one shining and emitting light out into its surroundings. But as you hold it up, notice that your diamond could do with a bit of a polish, that some of the facets aren't quite as bright as the others. And see yourself holding a velvet cloth that contains all of the love you've ever received. And take that cloth, begin to shine your diamond, bringing it back to complete brilliance, so that the light can not only shine straight through, but can be reflected out into the world and into the lives of all you touch. Know that this is your diamond. And in the quietness, allow yourself to stay with this image for as long as you like, allowing yourself to give in and let go more and more and more. And know that in a few minutes I will be back to bring you back out of the quietness, to re-emerge, shining and sparkling, back out into the world. Thank you. very gently. Very, very gently. Allow your awareness to come back into the present. Very, very gently. Allow your awareness to come back into the room, back into your body. But bring back any thoughts or feelings, any insights from the relaxation, but most importantly, bring back the feelings of peace and harmony that you have created within your body, your mind, and your emotions. Gently allow the image of the diamond to fade. And put it somewhere safe, inside your heart. There is a secret chamber in our heart that resonates at the same frequency as the King's Chamber in the Great Pyramid at Giza, and at the same frequency of our Earth's resonance. So connect once again with that energy at your heart and find that secret chamber within it. You'll know when you get there because it will feel different. It will feel stronger. This is the place within us that connects us to all life everywhere. So see yourself placing your diamond in that secret chamber. And then allow the image to fade. Allow your breath now to deepen once again. And as you do, welcome the breath back into your body. And feel how much it revitalizes and rejuvenates you. Allow the prana that comes in with the breath to energize every single molecule of every cell in your body. And know that in the quietness, you released and let go, not only tensions in your physical self, but tensions that may exist on every other level of your being. And when you're ready, allow the fingers and toes to move once again. And then allow your head to gently ease from side to side, waking up the neck. Feel the life returning to your spine and your entire body. Then, when you're ready, take your arms back behind your head and have a big stretch, opening up the body, breathing more deeply, and welcoming the life back into every organ, every muscle, every bone, every nerve, and of course, back into your head and your brain. See your brain switched on, lit up with light. And you can come back into the waking world.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.